Cartoon pandas, cars that look like geisha girls, feminized robots, decorated kitchen timers. Asian Americans are represented in objects both admired and feared. How do stereotypes about Asian Americans find their way into items all around us? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is University of Wisconsin-Madison Professor of English and Asian American Studies, Leslie Bowe. In her 2022 Duke University Press book, Racist Love, Asian Abstraction and the Pleasures of Fantasy, she traces the ways in which Asian Americans become objects of anxiety and desire. Previous books include Partly Colored, Asian Americans and Racial Anomaly in the Segregated South, and Betrayal and Other Acts of Subversion, Feminism, Sexual Politics, and Asian American Women's Literature. Leslie, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much, Emily, and thank you for having me.
I'm intrigued by the oxymoron in your title, Racist Love. We don't think of racism and love as going together. It's almost like saying hateful love. So tell me about the title, the subtitle, and why you wrote this book.
So let me start with that paradox of the title that you've pointed out. So, you know, in terms of race, we have a very clear sense of how racial hatred is enacted. We rarely, though, think about the way in which race functions as a kind of conduit for desires. And I begin with a very, visceral feeling among some of us that people have this uneasy feeling when someone really over compliments their culture. And so that a queasy feeling is the basis for racist love, which actually comes from an article written by two very early 1972 Asian American writers prior to the Asian American movement politics around the same time, which was describing the duality of racial stereotypes in the United States, not only for Asian Americans, but for others as well. So they talked about the duality of racial stereotypes like step and fetch it, which is a kind of racist love type, the servile servant, right? That the position of these racial figures like Charlie Chan's number one son was really in service to white supremacy. And so how we love, quote unquote, love these figures because they are servile to us is the basis of their writing about racist love. And so I kind of took that as a broader consideration of what we do when we fetishize racial things. And for Asian Americans in particular, that is a very hefty, significant, effective construct.
Can you talk a little bit about, you use the word fetishize. So what constitutes a fetish and how might that apply to our approach to Asian Americans?
So when we talk about fetishism, we can talk about both the classic Freudian concept, but also push into more colloquial, phrases like cultural appropriation. So the classic idea of fetishism is really a kind of paradoxical desiring structure in which the fetishist has created in an object of arousal a kind of ability to foreclose castration anxiety. So that's Freud's concept of the fetish. Like why, someone would have arousal around an object is really to forestall a specific kind of fear or a specific kind of anxiety. And when you think about issues of racist love through cultural appropriation. And so for one thing, prior to this book's coming out, had been quoted multiple times on mainstream media about the phenomena of blackfishing. So blackfishing is this phenomena when non-black women take on the style of African-American women. So box braids, skin color, certain forms of makeup. And there was this big, question in mainstream culture, well, what is blackfishing and why should we be concerned about it? And the concern really is that taking on abstracted racial attributes through the notion of style was a sense of appropriating for one's own and possessing, some aspect of culture that then conveys a certain kind of cool, right, in the United States. And thinking about the idea of cultural appropriation, really it is about race fetishism. You know, how do you create a desired object that has racialized meaning in the United States through not the people themselves, but through the things that connote them? And for me, it's obvious to say Asian food fetish, like, is one of those things. The fetishization of Asian women as a point of eroticism in American culture is another. But as you mentioned in your intro, there are all these little things like little tchotchkes, like, you know, kitchen timers that are shaped in the shape of these diminutive Asianized people with little cartoon slanted eyes that, you know, are very appealing in American culture because they signify Asian peoples, but they're not the peoples themselves. And so that's really an interesting phenomenon to me, to see this idea of Asianness not on an actual human body, but displaced onto a thing, whether it's a robot or a car, you know, or a little kitchen timer. And I find that that phenomenon very intriguing.
And it seems that there's this ambivalence that maybe you find something cute and adorable. At the same time, there's a discomfort that we feel if you take certain elements like eye shape and you put that on a kitchen timer, what are we saying exactly?
Yeah. What I think that I ended up doing was thinking a lot about the nature of ethnic caricature. So in mainstream culture, we have a taboo now, for good reason, about ethnic Halloween costumes. Because the question is, what is the harm of those costumes? What do they actually do? And what they actually do is kind of reduce an entirety of a landmass, a culture, a people into recognizable tropes or traits, the sombrero, the sarape, the mustache, right? For Mexican Americans. For Asian Americans, it's always the hair. It's the slant of the eyes. So the notion
of
a certain
shape of a hat.
That's right, the coolie hat.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and I think, you know, what's intriguing to me about how those traits are then placed upon objects to instill a certain kind of mockery, right? That is the basis of the stereotype itself. You know, what do we get out of it? We get out of a sense of, like, mockery, right, or humor. And I think that's the basis of caricature, that first it instills a certain kind of feeling, right? And it does so through a reduction and exaggeration. And that's kind of like the paradox of stereotyping or visual caricature itself, is that it always takes these one or two traits and then magnifies them. So that's the entirety of the people or the culture. And that is the basis of the fetish, right? It's object reduction for feeling, you know, how you feel about it, whether that feeling is lust or eroticism, or whether it's humor, or whether it's affection.
In all cases, it's like the quote you include in your book from Bell Hooks, it's getting a bit of the other.
Yeah, and I love that article. Bell Hooks has a piece called Eating the Other, and it's basically a form of racist love. Like, what do you get out of consuming racial ethnic difference in the United States? And her thesis is that race and ethnicity can function as the, quote, spice to white homogeneity in American culture. You know, that basically we eat Asian food, we dress a certain way, we drive a certain car, you know, to imbibe the associations for a group that is not our own, right? And so this very idea of sexuality, right? So adventuring in terms of people of color as partners, romantic partners in the United States, is only one aspect of that. But she goes further to say, oh, but it's in the way that we dress. It's in the foods that we eat. And so that notion of consumption, right, of how we consume difference, is the foundation to this book, Racist Love.
You write in your book that Asian Americans appear to confuse the association between race and disadvantage because they are the so-called model minority. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so what's interesting about the paradoxical relationship to Asian Americans in the United States is that they actually encompass such a wide economic and geographical group, you know, geographic origin group in the United States, that it is difficult to talk about them as homogenous group. I mean, you basically can't. I mean, Asian Americans in the United States are among the highest, you know, household earners in the United States and also among the lowest, right? And a lot of that has to do with the history of immigration to the United States and on what, you know, visa, you know, you're allowed to immigrate, you know, whether it's a refugee status, whether it's family reunification, or whether it's, you know, a work visa that privileges certain kinds of STEM and tech arenas. And so Asian Americans have been cast as through this stereotype of the model minority as being, you know, modeling exactly the kind of values in the United States that we want all racial ethnic groups to have, right? This idea of diligence and hard work and family values and valuing education. You know, at the same time, not all Asian American groups reflect, and not all individuals by any means reflect that back, that stereotype. And so then you see this kind of paradox working out where even the trope, the characterization model minority is itself a form of racist love. We're saying, well, we really love you for these values, but also we're reducing you as a full, you know, peoples, right, in the United States because we desire to fix you in these traits that essentially are not about Asian Americans at all. They're leveraged against other minority groups in the United States.
It's interesting that, you know, when I was looking for some music, some audio ideas for what would go along well with this topic, I found a song called Safe by a group called Dumbfounded, where, and, you know, some of this would have to be censored a little bit, the language is something, but it's kind of taking that stereotype of the model minority that doesn't, that's always polite, that's always safe, and kind of, you know, pushing back about that. So the lyrics include, "You ain't never seen a yellow boy wilding, yellow boy shining, sound the alarm." And also saying that I watched the Oscars and the only yellow men were all statues, and referring to a bamboo ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
You took me as safe. That was your first mistake. Who said I was safe? The other night I watched the Oscars and the roster of the only yellow men were all statues.
Whoa.
We a quarter of the population, there's a room of f***ing 1% is laughing at you.
Yeah.
F*** a bamboo ceiling. Guess I gotta play the villain. ODB up at the Grammys on the mic like Wu-Tang is for the children.
Whoa.
Bruce Jenner is a woman, OJ was acquitted, Kim K is a hero.
Hero.
The sky is the limit, any minute now, they gon' let a Asian brother get a lead roll. Shots fired, I'ma reload. Never saw the side of Chino. He was always quiet, keeping to himself. Never mess with anybody else. That's the Jonathan that we know.
Seems so safe.
It almost seemed to be pushing back against the idea of being silent,
mm-hmm.
being, you know, accepting of whatever it is, and suggesting that there could be a fight back. I hadn't heard the phrase bamboo ceiling before. Is that something that's used widely?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the glass ceiling versus the bamboo ceiling, you know, is what's being, you know, referenced
right.
there. And, you know, there are Chinese American groups in the United States, so they're very, you know, we all want to see the U.S. is a sort of meritocracy, right? And so any glass ceiling for women or any bamboo ceiling for Asian Americans, you know, the whole case of admissions at Harvard is certainly a reflection of, you know, people are saying, oh, well, you know, is this a manifestation of that where you can rise, but only so far? And I think that that idea that there is still systemic discrimination in terms of the workplace, you know, it's something that Asian Americans confront on a regular basis because it's the way in the limits of the stereotype is, well, you know, you're diligent and you're hardworking, but then the flip side is, but you are not, you know, creative or daring or original or capable of leadership. And I think that that's where the idea of this stereotype on a continuum of positive to negative, right, comes in, because we're thinking like racist love and racist hate are basically just flip sides of the same phenomena.
Can you talk a little bit about the history behind some of this? You referred to what had been called Orientalism, mm-hmm, and the Chinese Exclusion Acts and immigration laws and yellow peril and so on. If we try to look at not the sort of fantasy and objects now, but some of the factual history that's underlying some of these attitudes and lingering stereotypes, can you just talk a little bit about that? What is the most important thing to know, would you say, about Asian American history leading up to some of the that racist hatred, whether you call it, I mean, it's flip side, like you say, racist love, racist hate. Mm-hmm. What are some of the factual things that are undergirding that?
I think that the connection between the facts or an empirical reality and the idea of a fantasy of people that you have in your head are intimately entwined, right? So my field is literature, where one could say, well, why is literature important? It's all made up. It's not quote-unquote true. What we need to know is sociology. You know, what's the where are the empirical facts that we can say about any one group, right, in the United States? And because I come from the discipline of literature, my view is a little bit different, which is to say that the basis, the foundational basis of history is not so different from the imagination, right, or creates the foundation of the imagination that we have of a people and specifies their use value to us. So the idea of the of Asian exclusion beginning with Chinese Americans but moving rapidly in the beginning of the 20th century to Chinese, to Koreans, to Filipinos, to Asian Indians, that kind of movement of an exclusionary net to encompass all groups, racial groups that came from this continental mass or the Pacific Islands, it's basically, you know, on the basis of economic, you know, competition with labor in the 19th century. So it was a nativist movement of the sort that we still see going on today. So that's one of the foundations of the negative portrayal. Like, how do you actually say that certain groups are such good workers that we cannot compete with them, therefore we have to vilify them in a cultural way as being unassimilable, as being heathen, as being so different from our notions of sexuality or hygiene, you know, or any of those things, that they must be excluded from our nation. And so that is actually why Asian American populations were so small to begin with in the 20th century. And now, after the changes to immigration in 1965, they stand to have the biggest growth, right, in terms of immigrant groups in the United States. Now, the problem is those tropes that were 19th century tropes still do apply to a lot of Asian Americans and anti-immigration sentiment that surrounds them. So that's one of the foundations for this idea of the imaginative belief system that we have, you know, about Asian Americans in the United States.
The first chapter of your book focuses on children's literature, children's books, teenage graphic novels, and so on. And you talk about how it's kind of odd that we think children need to approach other races through the idea of depicting them as different species of animals. Can you talk a little bit about that and some of the things you saw when you were looking at children's books?
Yeah. You know, we think of children's literature as being so, you know, positive now in its orientation and towards sensitivity, racial sensitivity in particular. And one of the things I was noticed in when I was reading children's literature is how often Asian Americans were depicted as animals that were indigenous to you know, Asian land masses, you know, so there was this definitely weird convergence between indigeneity of species, of animal species, and the way in which these anthropomorphic characters were depicted. And so the one of the things that I was looking at in this book was the way that so often Asian American adoptees were portrayed as pandas or different forms of bear, you know, and what that was supposed to be doing for the child. And what it was supposed to be doing for the child was to say, okay, even though you don't look like your adopted parent, right? Because in this case, it was a cat adopting a puppy or, you know, a polar bear adopting a panda. You know, even though you don't look like, you know, your adopted parent, it's okay, we don't love you any less. And that's a really heartfelt, wonderful message. At the same time, I was like, okay, let's take a little bit further of a look at this and actually think about what it's doing when you graft animal species difference onto human beings, right? As a form of like seemingly neutral biodiversity. And I'll just describe one, you know, picture that I was looking at, which actually comes from, and my children read this book multiple, you know, times. It's a series called Miss Bindergarten's Kindergarten. And the benefit of Miss Bindergarten's Kindergarten is that every single animal is portrayed as a different type of animal, and the alphabetic letter corresponds to the type. So A, alligator, Adam, right? And so one of the things that this book is doing in a very subtle way, and I'm very supportive of this, is actually to model the notion of diversity through biodiversity, right? Through different animals portraying different kinds of children, right? And that visual is very potent. We all belong together. We're all in harmony, even though we are all different from each other. And I want it to foreground, you know, basic pedagogical strategies like that, not to necessarily to critique them, but to take a second glance at that and say, well, what do we gain and what do we lose by portraying racial difference through differences among species, animal species?
You mean it's almost suggesting in a certain way that people from different races are not all human, and it's kind of reinforcing the opposite of what you might be trying to do.
And that in keeping with even more, you know, suspicious old school portrayals in which if you look at Richard Scarry's Busy, Busy World, you know, all the indigenous animals are dressed up in the costumes of the people that surround them. You know, so like the Asian elephant has to wear a turban, as does the Asiatic tiger, right? You know, so that's a form of caricature that we recognize as very and deeply suspect, right? For clear reasons for exactly, you know, what you said. But then, you know, there are more complicated reasons for that, which is to say like, oh, well, do children really pick up those like cues about differences? And does it make them less prejudiced against people who are, quote, different from themselves? And I think the answer is no.
Lots to think about. One of the other topics that you already mentioned was the depiction of Asian women and stereotypes about that. And we're going to look at that from Madame Butterfly to contemporary robots that are made to look like Asian women when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
To run really fast, to get rid of this sand, to eat a whole cake, get crazy with frosting,
no escort, no manners,
no nursemaids,
no worries, no hands folded perfect,
like holding a lily.
No pinchy shoes?
I wanna be like other girls, scrape up my knee like other girls can, just to be free like other girls, get to be.
That's from Disney's Mulan, I Want to Be Like Other Girls. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Professor Leslie Bowe, and we are talking about her book, Racist Love, Asian Abstraction and the Pleasures of Fantasy. One of the topics that comes up a lot when you talk about Asian American stereotypes is the depiction of women. And, you know, that goes all the way to different forms, whether it's Madame Butterfly, or, you know, just different depictions that are in literature, in films, in music. Can you talk about that and the origin of the stereotype of the Asian woman as exotic and submissive and therefore sexually desirable?
Yeah, Emily, I think, you know, because you had asked me about the foundations of racial hatred earlier in the program. And in these chapters, I really trace back that idea of the exoticism of Asian women to the U.S. military and the foreign wars that were involved in the second half of the 20th century, which, you know, as anyone who knows history, where they actually took place in Japan, in Vietnam, in South Korea, you know, so much of in military bases in the Philippines, you know, so is it, you know, a coincidence then that is that it's the Asian woman who gets fetishized as the, you know, quintessential sexual object, if in fact the whole history of U.S. imperialism in that region is about setting up R&R or relax and recreation camps outside those military bases there. And so for me, that is the foundation for this quote-unquote stereotype of Asian women as hyper-feminine, hyper-exoticized, making the best wives. You know, this kind of fetishization of Asian women's sexuality really derives from that history.
And if you look at the stereotype as Asian women as innocent, willing to please, sexually desirable, vulnerable, how is that related to becoming victims of sexual trafficking?
I mean, I think that when we're talking about global human trafficking in the world, I do think that the idea of sex tourism has a hand in that. And that way back, right, in the beginning of when you think about military conflict and the comfort women who were sexual slaves to the Japanese Imperial Army – the fact that that was taken up, you know, by other military units, right? Not in the terms of non-consent, but definitely in terms of, like, you know, contemporary sex trafficking. I think that has a really clear trajectory, right, in the global history of sex trafficking. And so one of the things that I do in this book is to look at the ways in which that has entered our popular cultural imagination, right, in terms of fantasy depictions of Asian women bodies as some kind of sexual slave. And so when we think of popular movies like Ex Machina or Cloud Atlas, you see those kind of tropes replicated that come from real world historical circumstances. But here they're represented through fantasy dystopias, right? And I found that kind of continuation of that characterization really disturbing and also kind of intriguing, because one of the things they do is replicate exactly that stereotype. But they also begin to script, I think, our view of technology itself, because a lot of these women are portrayed in these fantasy media not as quote unquote real women, but as machines.
And what does that mean? You know, why is this being done, do you think?
I think first it begins with that historical connection or association with women who are there to serve you, whether sexually or in terms of your household, this idea of things that are built for service, and then shifting over to technology. You know, how do we make machines serve us and to what end? You know, because one of the questions that I pose in this book is, gee, well, you know, why imagine AI or artificial intelligence as embodied in the first place? You know, the whole beauty of AI is that it doesn't have a material body, right? And so for all these fantasy sequences and media and movies to portray robots or AI through the embodiment of young, bodily, normative, Asian eyes females, like, what does that do? And, you know, to me, the answer is, well, it begins to script our relationship to a potentially threatening form of technology. And in fact, that's what happens in some of these scripted dramas that engage those kinds of robotics. But when you think about the way in which actual robots are recreated in China or Japan is the leader in that, in terms of like real life kind of robotic figures, they really actually begin to say, oh, you know, here's a machine that can be ordered around. Right. Mastery of technology is supposed to be the point of how you interact with the machine. And the embodiment then therefore enables that kind of relationship.
So you're saying if a robot is depicted as an Asian woman, it is a way to make it seem less threatening, less scary, because the stereotype associates that look with being docile or being miniature.
Right. And so one of the actual robotic figures that I talk about in the book is named Aiko. And she's an invention from a Canadian inventor who fashioned her look on the basis of Japanese anime. And so in the early 2000s, what he did was put sensors underneath her skin so that it would mimic the pain response, right, of actual feeling in the limbs. And so he takes her to these technology shows. And so the point is that when you touch the robot, it responds as if it's being hurt. So you touch its skin and then it says, ow, that hurts. Or your hand is so soft, it tickles. Or when you punch her, she says, that hurts, stop. You know, don't touch me. You know, and it's so funny, you know, to see that. Well, not funny. When you see little boys interacting, you know, with this Asian female robot form, it looks like kind of a mannequin, but she's moving, emanating these statements of resistance to their touch. What you realize is, even as a point she's saying no, the robot is literally saying, no, don't touch me. No, that hurts. No, stop. But to the boys in these tech shows, it's actually a point of hilarity, because the point in the show is not to stop. It's to keep going to see what the robot's going to do.
That makes you pretty uncomfortable to think about what the message is. And you do talk about how sometimes what looks like a compliment or admiration is this, there's that flip side, too, of it being very insulting and offensive. It's a strange mixture. You refer also not to the sort of contemporary robot side, but looking back at the Seinfeld show, Jerry Seinfeld, about loving Chinese women, says, if I like their race, how can that be racist?
Yeah. And I think that's basically the foundation for this book, to basically lay out at the outset, you know, why that is so. And why that is so is that it's that love is on the basis of some difference that has become magnified for you, that is basically a reduction of an entire human being to one's racial attributes, right? So it is love that is enabled by abstraction, right? It's a love that's enabled by a stereotypical reduction. And so that's the insulting part, right? It's not necessarily the love part. It's the reduction that necessarily accompanies it. And that's why people have a very like queasy feeling when someone tells them that they love them because of the way that they look on the basis of their race.
Yeah, I can see that that's very problematic. So I want to share something that's actually bothered me for decades now. It's a public radio situation that occurred back when I did a 4-hour series with the late Amy Ling, who used to direct the Asian American Studies program at UW. And she did 4 hours of programming about Asian American literature, older literature, but also contemporary writers from Amy Tan to Maxine Hong Kingston, looking at the variety of places that were represented and themes and the complexity of those literary works. And there were people who wrote in and wanted reading lists and were complimentary. But the one call that came in to the radio station was from a man from northern Wisconsin who said, "She sounds like she'd make a great Asian bride for me. Could you give me her contact information?" And it stayed in my head all these years, because that's been probably 25 years ago, that after listening to 4 hours of programming about the depths of Asian American experience and humanity, that he was still looking at this stereotype that we were trying to dispel. Do you worry with the publication of your book, where it talks about everything from Hello Kitty to Pokemon to, you know, different songs and movies and kitchen items? Do you worry that in the process of talking about stereotypes, you may perpetuate them?
And that's a really good question, Emily, because the absolute worry of this and the basis of the story that you just told is the realization that whatever you have to say, the fantasy that people have in their heads about other peoples who are different from themselves will overwrite any intellectual thing that you have to say about the construction, right, about where and how and why they get those fantasies implanted in their heads. And I, it's funny because I'm on the other side of things where I want to complicate exactly those sets of relations. You know, I'll tell you a parallel story because you mentioned the reaction to Amy Ling. And, you know, to me, the parallel story actually comes from what appears on the cover of my book here, which is the back of an Asian woman's head portraying only her hair. And the reason that I chose that is I think it's actually an aesthetically gorgeous, you know, piece of charcoal on paper. But I was told the story by an academic man who went to China, and I asked him, you know, how did you end up meeting your wife? He said he went to China in which she was playing in the orchestra, but all he could see was the back of her head. And he ended up falling in love with the back of her head. And he told me that story like, oh, this is so incurably romantic. And I heard that story and I was like, oh, wow, that's kinky. You know, and it's exactly what you're describing about this Colin, is that whatever this person loved about China was so potent, you know, and so magnified that all he needed was the back of his head to imagine the perfect woman. And in fact, that is what he was telling me. And so part of one of the challenges of the book is to say, okay, let's look at that as a racial fantasy and let's break down the desiring structures of the fetish to understand what function that may serve for not just individual people, but a culture as a whole. And so then the question becomes, oh, how is it that Asian Americans, through this notion of racist love, are meeting the needs, the demands, or the dreams of some kind of racial formation in the United States that is really not about attraction? It's actually dealing with anxiety. And I think that would be the shocking, you know, part of it for the racial fetishists to realize. It's like for both of the men that we were talking about, the call-in men and the guy who falls in love with the back of a woman's head, it's really to say, well, what are you afraid of so much about real women that you have to and you need to have some kind of weird construction, right, going on in your head that is political because it's gendered and because it is racialized in this case. And so as we approach the 21st century and China is becoming the big bad for the United States in terms of China threat theory or any kind of, military mobilization, now it's going to be, you know, outwards to this larger, you know, Chinese formation. That's not going to go away, right? Those anxieties may become more fully manifested as either racial hatred, right, as in the violence that's going on against Asian elders and women on the street. But it will also come out through this professed attraction. And I'm curious about noting that paradox once again.
You also talk about the horror of the 2021 murders at an Atlanta spa, which seemed to be targeting six Asian women.
Yes. Yes, I talk about that. And in that formation, when you think about the continuum of feeling between racist love and racial hatred, it's exactly the process that I want to emphasize there. You know, it's that for this man, you know, Asian women became the temptresses to his own desire that he could not himself confront. And so these middle-aged spa workers were the embodiment of whatever he had in his head that was that racial fantasy, that was a point of threat, not simply desire, but a threat, right, to him. And so these women of individuals could be part of the whole, that they could represent and embody the whole of a culture or of a people. This is exactly that kind of formation that is tied to the notion of fetishization and the stereotype itself, right? Mm-hmm. That one individual must be made to stand in for the whole of a culture, a people, a continent, a landmass, and that kind of magnification of imagination is what I think underlies the stereotype.
More on racist love and the objectifying of Asian Americans when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Hey, look, Wes. Here is a picture of my dad, Victor.
Oh, you look just like him.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Annalyn. Are you ready to make a family scrapbook?
Yeah, you are right on time.
Yeah.
Annalyn, is everything all right?
I was at the park today, and the boy told me I was ugly. He made fun of my eyes. He said they look slanty.
Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. That child was wrong to say those things to you. Your eyes are the perfect eyes for you.
Yeah.
Just like my eyes are the perfect ones for me.
I told him that he was wrong and that he hurt my feelings. My friends stood by me, but is it true? Are my eyes ugly?
No, you have pretty eyes.
Everything about you is beautiful, both inside and out.
Thanks, but I'm still really sad.
That's from Sesame Street. Your eyes tell the story of your family and the notion of bullying a girl based on the shape of her eyes. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Leslie Bowe, and we are talking about her book, Racist Love, Objectifying Asian Americans. There's a lot of objects that you have pictures of in your book where the only thing or the main thing that kind of stamps them as Asian American would be the shape of the eyes. Can you talk about that and the way that has been used and misused?
Yeah, so a lot of the images that I'm talking about in terms of how you create an Asianized anthropomorphic form in something as innocuous as a kitchen timer or a cookie jar, you know, or a perfume bottle.
Salt, you had salt yes. shakers, you've got yeah. all kinds of different things where it's made to look like an Asian figure.
Yeah, and that to me is a 21st iteration of what we recognize in the segregation era United States, particularly in the South, as a very, you know, harmful form of, you know, creating racialized stereotypes grafted on to household objects.
And you talk about how there's a movement to get rid of figures in other cultures, whether it's Aunt Jemima, you know, the sort of mammy figure. You can look at other cultures where a certain stereotypical attribute is, you know, it's so offensive that it wouldn't be allowed.
And that's why I was surprised, you know, to find some of these images and objects circulated. So, for example, I picked up this juicer and an Italian purveyor of household goods, upscale purveyor of household goods. You know, and so the juicer is basically in the shape of a kind of Mandarin figure with a Mandarin canonical hat with his gigantic slanted eyes as a means to convey that he's supposed to be a Chinese Mandarin citrus juicer. And it was yellow. And I was like, well, you know, is this supposed to look like me? You know, or is this supposed to be Chinese? And I was like, isn't there a taboo against these kinds of forms of caricatures? And so the surprise was, you know, in this day and age that, you know, people were not blinking an eye at that kind of representation. And here's part of the complication to that, which is what I talk about in the book. You know, so I recognize those as a kind of kawaii form, or what in Japan is called cute style. And, you know, in the United States, you recognize that aesthetic, you recognize that form is everywhere. You know, walking down State Street, there's a very cute rendition of the Badger and the Capitol Dome on the outside of the Target on State Street. Really adorable kind of representation of little cartoon figures. And so when I began to notice that that style or form was being grafted on, right, to a lot of these household goods, I mean, I think that that spoke to me as to why these things were now allowable or were not, you know, causing a big fuss. And it was not simply that they were Asianized, it was that they were cute. You know, and so the complication for me is when I'm talking about that Alessi juicer, I immediately bought it. And I was like, oh, this is incredibly disgusting. And at the same time, I was like, oh, my God, this is so cute. I have to have it. And really coming in a kind of more thoughtful way about how aesthetic form dictates our view of race, too, is part of one of the things that I wanted to talk about in this book. But also, you know, when I think back on childhood, one of the things that I had is a Nutcracker suite from Disney. It was from the movie Fantasia. And on the cover were these little mushroom characters that went with Chinese dance, right, in the Nutcracker suite. And they're little adorable, cute dancing mushrooms, but they had those mustaches and slanty eyes that are supposed to convey that they are Chinese.
And the hat. So the mushroom caps are made to almost look like the hats.
Right. And so that that's part of my childhood. And at the time, I would never have said, oh, my God, that's me. That's so racist. You know, I just had that album. Well, as an adult with the intellectual knowledge that I have about the harm, right, that stereotypes and caricature are meant to convey, it's a kind of mockery. It's a kind of reduction. Let's just say that at the outset. The complication for me is like, oh, those mushrooms are pretty cute, you know, so that even when Disney re-sanitized Fantasia, it actually ended up cutting out a lot of the more harmful stereotypical images of other groups. And yet it kept this mushroom, Chinese little cute mushroom, in. Hmm. And for me, you know, thinking about, oh, so is it that this kind of affront doesn't, you know, affect Asian Americans or Chinese people? And I think, no, it was something about the form of the way that those mushrooms were drawn that still draws you in, you know. And so the complication for Asian American spectatorship of some of these tchotchkes that I'm talking about is, well, they are supposed to be really cute. They are supposed to elicit, you know, a certain kind of affection, right, by the very diminutive nature, this minimalist, you know, line drawing of these forms. And for me, that's a kind of complication that I was wrestling with what I knew intellectually about specific images.
What about the car, the geisha car in Pixar's Cars 2?
Yeah, there's an image in this book that comes from Cars 2, a very side character of a Japanese car when they're on a road rally, and it's obviously supposed to be in the style of Japan. And I have, you know, those kinds of mixed feelings about what that is actually supposed to be doing. It's basically making a car into an Asian woman. And the question is like, well, is that the idea of caricature and mockery? Is it the idea of, well, every car has an ethnicity in this fantasy universe, you know? And how do we feel about this as an object of intellectual analysis versus how do we feel about it as just a graphic image, you know? And so then to be able to talk about the conflict maybe between an intellectual reading, an affective or an emotional reading is also part of the complication of this book.
Any comments about Hello Kitty, Pokemon, other kind of things like that that are part of our culture that we might not be thinking about too closely?
It's funny because I've seen the little pictures of Hello Kitty dressed in a kimono to advertise sushi and to advertise actually the Hello Kitty exhibit at the Japanese American Museum in Los Angeles. And, you know, part of what I talk about, you know, with my students is like, well, how do you go about deciding what is adorable and what is offensive, right? And to me, that's a – I'm not going to say I'm going to give you the answer, you know, to that because that is your analysis. That is your reading. And for some people, they had never considered even the question of why that could be offensive, like to dress up an animal or your dog, right, in a kind of ethnic costume. And so it's kind of an eye-opener for them. But then to allow for the space of spectatorship to say, but I'm still drawn to that, you know. And I think that's the complication that people don't associate necessarily with a field, right, like Asian American Studies, where people come in thinking, like, I know what you're going to say, you know. I wanted to say that one of the things that I began with in terms of writing this book was trying to understand why, you know, students at Wisconsin are required to take an ethnic studies course. And sometimes I would get these students at the very end of their careers. They're seniors. They left it to the last moment, you know, to fulfill this requirement because not so much of you know, resistance, but just reluctance. And I couldn't figure that out, especially because they really were going out for Asian food or being a fan of BTS, you know, the Korean mm-hmm. pop group, or, you know, being part of the manga club or, you know, things like this, that they were imbibing Asian popular culture on a regular basis. And yet, you know, kind of repudiating wanting to learn more about Asian American studies, not necessarily as an object of study, but as a lens to critique the world, a lens to see the world through. And so I thought, you know, I can kind of work with that professed attraction to those things so that I can get them to understand this broader frame of how you see racial structure, how you see economic structure, how you see gendered structures that are hiding in plain sight. You know, for me, that was the beginning of the book to say, there's a disconnect between all this expressed attraction to Asianized things and yet a reluctance to engage in an intellectual way with Asian American studies.
I found your book absolutely eye-opening. I found it interesting that you called your concluding chapter Racist Hate, Racist Profiling, and Pokemon at Auschwitz, but the title of the overall book, Racist Love, maybe suggests possibilities for change and something that's a little bit more hopeful if we continue to question everything that we see. My guest has been Leslie Bowe. Thank you so much for being with me, Leslie.
Thank you so much, Emily, for having me. And good luck with the series.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.